This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Discover Magazine. Each week, we explore our amazing world through the pages of Discover. From the natural sciences to technological breakthroughs, there is always something new to learn on Discover. Coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Discover Science, and I'm your reader, Brad, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the June issue of Scientific American, copyright 2025. And now, I'll begin with What Would Aliens See? By Phil Plait. Can extraterrestrials detect our civilization from a distance? So far, astronomers have discovered nearly 6,000 exoplanets, worlds that orbit stars other than the Sun. If that number already feels ridiculously large, you'd better brace yourself. Extrapolation of that total suggests there could be hundreds of billions of planets in our galaxy alone. So a fraction of them will be like Earth, although at the moment, we don't know what that fraction is. Still, with an amount that huge, even a small percentage of Earth-like orbs could mean a lot of habitable planets. That's why most scientists take the idea of life on other worlds seriously. Life arose here pretty rapidly, practically as soon as Earth had cooled enough to harbor oceans, which implies that it's easy to get started once conditions are clement. The timing of the advent of hazily defined higher-order features, such as intelligence and technology, however, is a different question, and one about which we are mostly restricted to speculation, although there have been some interesting investigations. But let's say that right now there are intelligent aliens and technological civilizations out there somewhere in the Milky Way. Could they detect us? With the question phrased that way, in the most general sense, the answer is yes. By this, I mean there's no physical reason you couldn't build an immense telescope, one far, far larger than any currently in existence, that would be capable of taking a detailed image of a planet from a great many light years away. The engineering task may be considerable, but it's not technically impossible. Then it might only be a matter of seeing city lights at night, for example, to confirm that aliens, that is, humans, because we'd be alien to them, exist. In fact, it may even be easier than that. A much smaller telescope need not resolve the planet, just observing it well enough to watch it get brighter and dimmer as nighttime cities rotate in and out of view might be good enough. And that smaller telescope would have to be, let's say, only ridiculously huge instead of overwhelmingly so. The reason to wonder about any of this is that it flips the script on what's usually asked, which is how we can detect aliens given our current level of technology. We can't know their level in advance, but we do know our own, so it makes sense to assume their tech is equivalent to ours, and then ask from what distance they could spot us. That task is actually extremely difficult. Space is big, and vast distances dim even the mightiest of civilizations. But we can use our own as a template and work backward to estimate the outer limits of any interstellar eavesdropping on our noisy little world by extraterrestrials that use similar technology. A team of astronomers headed by Sophia Sik of the SETI Institute has run the numbers on this question and published its results in the Astronomical Journal. SETI, SETI, stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The researchers looked at various methods of detecting our various so-called technosignatures and found that this answer, unsurprisingly, depends on which specific one any extraterrestrials would be looking for. Many such ideas have been investigated individually before, but this recent analysis examines them collectively and consistently to arrive at some fresh insights. One example of a technosignature is radio. Since its inception in the mid-20th century, SETI has focused on detecting artificial radio signals from space. Radio waves are easy to make and detect, and they can pass at the speed of light through interstellar space, scarcely impeded by any gas or dust that might be in the way. That makes radio a nearly ideal carrier for galactic range communication. The astronomers divided radio signals into four categories. First, pointed but intermittent broadcasts to space, essentially "we are here" messages. Second, intentional and persistent targeted signals sent to our planetary probes in deep space that continue on into the galaxy. Third, persistent omnidirectional signals, such as leakage emissions from cell phone towers, as well as radio and television stations. And fourth, signals from artifacts, such as low-power downlinks from our interplanetary probes. Signals in the first category can be detected from the farthest away because the power involved in their transmission is highest. Seek and her colleagues estimate that these waves can be spotted at a staggering 12,000 light-years from Earth. That's a maximum distance, but several billion stars lie within that range. If you want to be found, this is probably the way to go. The other methods don't fare as well. For the second category, the maximum distance is more like 65 light-years, which still includes thousands of stars. The third category gets out to only 4 light-years, which isn't even as far as the closest star to the Sun. The star, Proxima Centauri, is 4.25 light-years away. The fourth one, which would include signals from our spacecraft, such as the Voyager 1 probe, has a detection limit of just under 1 light-year away. That surprised me, given how weak the signal is now, when the spacecraft is only about 25 billion kilometers away. Voyager 1's 23-watt transmitter is already dimmed to less than a billionth of a watt, as seen from our world. Clearly, radio is the method of choice for aliens looking for Earth, but there are other signatures. One outcome of our modern civilization is an imprint on our atmosphere. Besides carbon dioxide, quite a few other chemicals have been dumped into our air by industry and other anthropogenic sources. Altering our planet's climate is not great, to say the least, but it does make a signature detectable from space, and that signature could be especially obvious for interstellar observers located along our solar system's ecliptic, the plane of Earth's orbit around the Sun. From that perspective, they would see our planet pass directly in front of our star once every year, slightly dimming its light. Called a transit, this has been the most successful method so far for discovering exoplanets. Such transits can also be used to remotely analyze a world's air. As starlight, or in our case, sunlight, passes through a planet's upper atmosphere, certain wavelengths of light will be absorbed by molecules there, creating a kind of fingerprint that can be measured. We already use this method to study some transiting exoplanets with the James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, and proposed future telescopes such as NASA's Habitable Worlds Observatory are meant to scan the atmospheres of dozens of potentially Earth-like exoplanets that may exist around nearby stars, even if they don't transit as seen from our solar system. In their study, the SETI Institute astronomers focused on the remote detection of nitrogen dioxide, or NO2, a conspicuous byproduct of fossil fuel burning. Given the current levels in our polluted air, they find that we could detect such a signature from a distance of 5.7 light-years. Only the Alpha Centauri system is within that range, which limits any aliens' options for uncovering us. Still, it's an impressive technological achievement to be able to do this kind of search at all. Most other types of technosignatures aren't as helpful. A JWST clone perched somewhere in the vicinity of Neptune's orbit could detect the infrared glow of heat emanating from our cities, but farther out that trail glows cold. At about 100 times that distance, the optical gleam of Earth's city lights would fade to black, better but still far short of even our nearest star. Lasers are easier to detect and are already being tested by NASA and the European Space Agency for in-space satellite communication. Still, under reasonable assumptions, a laser beam of focused light would be too dim to detect from a distance of just under 6 light-years, which is not enough to be spotted, even at Barnard Star, the second closest star system to our own. The worst case involves searches for our off-world technological artifacts. Earth's swarms of artificial satellites, for example, slightly change the amount of sunlight on our planet blocks during a transit, but not enough to be detectable, even from Mars. Suffice to say that if aliens were close enough to see such things, there would be far easier ways for them to spot us. All these numbers come with the pretty big caveat that the extraterrestrials are no more advanced technologically than we are. This assumption may be very conservative because, after all, we get more advanced all the time. We continue to build bigger telescopes, limited only by budget and the laws of physics, and we are still finding and developing new ways to investigate the cosmos, such as detecting neutrinos and gravitational waves. We've been doing what might be called modern astronomy for only a century or so, and it's difficult to predict where we might be 100 years hence. The galaxy has been around for billions of years. No one can say yet who else shares it with us or what they're using to explore it. The truth is out there, and turning our search for aliens inside out by looking from the outside in may best inform us on how to find it. Stormy Waters by Clara Moskowitz. Deadly storm surges may become more common and severe. The beginning of June marks the start of the Atlantic hurricane season, the six-month period when strong storms can brew in the ocean and then wreak havoc on land. Among the hazardous consequences of hurricanes are storm surges, in which water rapidly rises above the normal tide level on shore. These dangerous events can cause flooding and pick up and displace homes and other structures. Water is very powerful, says Heather Nepal, meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Hurricane Center in Miami. It can be a deadly situation. Surges occur when the strong winds of a hurricane interact with ocean waters, piling up water ahead of the storm. As the hurricane heads toward shore, it travels over shallower ocean, and the water it carries has nowhere to go but upward onto land. How severe a surge will be depends on many factors, including the characteristics of the coastline and the intensity, size, and angle of approach of the storm. In general, though not always, stronger and larger storms produce higher storm surges. As the climate warms, hurricanes are becoming more intense, and sea levels are rising. Both of these effects are likely to worsen storm surges. Coastal areas that are already vulnerable to storm surge could experience worse impacts, and places that aren't quite vulnerable now may become increasingly at risk. 50, 100, and 150 years. Compiled by Mark Fischetti. Slavery by Ants is Self-Destructive, 1975. The institution of slavery is not quite to human societies. No fewer than 35 species of ants depend to some extent on slave labor for their existence. The techniques by which they raid other ant colonies to strengthen their labor force rank among the most sophisticated behavior patterns found in the insect world. Most of the slave-making species are so specialized as raiders that they starve to death if deprived of their slaves. Together, they display an evolutionary descent that begins with casual raiding by otherwise free-living colonies, passes through the development of full-blown warrior societies, and ends with such degeneration that the workers can no longer even conduct raids. Edward O. Wilson. Tornado outbreak, largest on record. During the spring and early summer, tornadoes are likely to occur between the Gulf of Mexico and Lake Ontario. On April 3rd of last year, conditions were right. The first tornado struck at 1:10 p.m. By 5:20 a.m. the next day, a total of 148 tornadoes had swept across the countryside and cities from Laurel, Mississippi to Windsor, Ontario, killing 315 people and injuring 5,484. In terms of sheer scope and the number of storms, it was the largest tornado outbreak on record. Immediately after, Theodore Fujita of the University of Chicago and his colleagues organized aerial and ground surveys. Fujita and his co-workers found that 74% of the fatalities occurred in houses and buildings, 17% in mobile homes, 6% in automobiles, and 3% among people en route to shelter. In 1971, Theodore Fujita and Alan Pearson introduced the Fujita-Pearson scale to describe tornado intensity from 0, wind speed less than 73 miles per hour, to 5, 261 to 318 miles per hour. Vacation Fun with Mud Dwellers, from 1925. The trouble with vacations is that they have a way of being just what their name implies, too vacant. Few human experiences are worse than that of the individual who finds themselves sitting around in the country or at the seashore with 24 hours a day on their hands and nothing interesting to do. Science can help. Anywhere in the out-of-doors, there is opportunity for real fun with science. In this issue, we describe some of the interesting things you can do and see with rocks and streams and the sides of hills, and we explain some secrets of the clouds. Another good way to make your vacation interesting is to study mud. In the bottoms of sluggish streams and small freshwater ponds, even water-filled ditches along the roadside, there is a vast and interesting world of tiny creatures. Science calls them animalcules, protozoa, protophyta, and other long names. You cannot see them without a microscope, but for the price of one weekend visit to a moderately fashionable resort, you can buy a microscope. You can take it out anywhere and discover this intensely interesting world of the mud dwellers. White ants destroy St. Helena, from 1875. White ants were introduced into St. Helena Island in the South Atlantic Ocean in 1840 in some timber from a slave ship. Mr. McLaughlin has identified the species Termes tenuis, peculiar to South America. The mischief it has done is almost incredible, and it appears to have gradually destroyed the whole of Jamestown. A considerable portion of the books in the library, especially theological literature, was devoured by them, and the whole of the interior would be destroyed without the exterior of the volumes seeming otherwise than intact. The insects are known today as Heteromites tenuis, a subterranean termite. Cooking with gas. A gas-burning cooking stove has been invented by B. Giles of Blackheath, England. He claims to have succeeded in cooking the most delicate dishes without their imbibing the slightest flavor from the products of combustion. Why Gross is Great, by Stephen C. George, from the July-August issue of Discover Science, copyright 2025, LabX Media Group. As you read through the table of contents, you could be forgiven for wondering if I had a group of fifth graders help me plan the issue, given some of the subject matter. Big stories on fruit flies and mucus? Bugs and boogers? Ew. Oh, and this issue's vital signs column features a wonderfully disgusting medical mystery. Like a lot of kids, I had a keen eye for all things icky and revolting when I was growing up. Still do, evidently. My friends and I delighted in sharing facts and stories that might gross out the average grown-up. Indeed, that was often our goal. But when I became an adult, and particularly as I became more interested in learning and writing about scientific research, I soon realized that some of the most astonishing and wonderful discoveries lurk just beneath a superficial veneer of slime and revulsion. Take the complex multiscale organic mesh that we all know as snot. It may be something we sneeze out, but it is nothing to sneeze at. The average human produces about a gallon of it per day, and it does so much more than filter microbes and clog our noses. As you'll learn in You and Your Mucus, our physical well-being and possibly our very lives depend on this sophisticated substance. Snot's not the only potential lifesaver you'll read about here. In Dr. Drosophila, you'll meet an unassuming species of fly that has, in its own way, helped shape more than a century of biomedical science. As the story notes, in labs all around the world, fruit flies are the key to scientists learning how diseases are passed down through our genes, how cancer cells proliferate, and even how chemical impulses travel through our brains. Or, as one young researcher succinctly puts it, fruit flies can be used to save the world. That's not grossness. That's greatness. The latest news and notes. Salamanders make the most of square feet. By Jenny Lehman. With their uniquely square-shaped toes, wandering salamanders are masters of movement, perfectly adapted for climbing, jumping, and gliding through the towering coastal forests of California and British Columbia. A study led by a Washington State University researcher recently uncovered the secret behind their remarkable agility. These salamanders can control the flow of blood through their veins in their vascularized toe tips, allowing them to expand and contract their toes' surface area. This mechanism enhances their grip, helping them attach and detach from the uneven surfaces of trees. Reported in the Journal of Morphology in January 2025, the findings could inspire innovations in fields like prosthetics and robotics. Harvesting History by Margarita Bossi. To address feeding the world's growing population, experts turn to 100-year-old wheat. In the 1920s and 30s, a British botanist named Arthur Ernest Watkins compiled the world's most comprehensive collection of local wheats. Concerned that technical advancements in breeding would decrease crop diversity, he had set out to collect land races, local varieties of wheat from around the world. Of the over 1,000 landrace samples that Watkins collected, 827 have survived to this day, having been replanted and reharvested at least every 5 years to ensure viability. In a paper published in Nature in June 2024, scientists proposed that this seed collection could fortify modern wheat agriculture, identifying genes within the collection that could increase modern wheat's resistance to pests and diseases. The research could help farmers feed the world's ever-increasing population. The Green Revolution of the mid-1900s brought about a dramatic increase in wheat production thanks to the development of high-yielding modern wheat varieties. But yield, as Watkins predicted, wasn't the only trait that changed. In the past 100 years, the wheat yield has increased, but our modern wheat cultivators are quite fragile, with dramatic reduction and homogenization of genetic diversity, says Xifeng Cheng, a study author and research professor at the Agricultural Genomics Institute at Shenzhen Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences. That's a big problem to ensure food security in the face of changing global climates, Cheng adds. While the wheats in the Watkins collection represent seven ancestral groups, modern wheats descend from only two. This lack of diversity makes crops more vulnerable to just about everything. If there is some unpredictable pest, disease, or climate change phenomenon, many of our wheats will be wiped out, Cheng explains. We needed to go back to the history, go back to the lost diversity. To do this, an international team turned to the Watkins collection. Diversity creates complexity for robustness and innovation, Cheng adds. Painstakingly analyzing the wheat, the team discovered that over 60% of the genetic diversity in the Watkins collection is not seen in modern cultivators. The Watkins wheat was collected 100 years ago, but each variety of wheat was grown and fed people for hundreds or even thousands of years, Cheng explains. They adapted well to local environments, could withstand environmental hardships, and maintained a rich, underutilized source of diversity. The team characterized and projected 137 traits from the land races into a genomic variation map, what Chang calls a gene dictionary, to help breeders bring genetic diversity back into modern wheat. Some of the lost traits identified by the scientists include slug resistance and resilience to pests and diseases. If we have a lot of diversity, when a new disease comes in, maybe there's a variety that is fortunately resistant to that disease. That's the ecosystem we need, Chang says. We need the diversity so we can deal with unpredictable events. The scientists have already crossed 119 varieties from the Watkins collection with modern wheats to make 12,000 new varieties. Ultimately, the Watkins collection provides a beacon of hope for the development and adoption of hardier crops to feed the world, now and in the future. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Brad with Discover Science. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.